This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, spring flooding is occurring all over the country, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has a program to do something about it. It appears human arrogance about controlling nature has no limit. Tim Wirth, president of the foundation set up by Ted Turner to donate $1 billion to the United Nations, tells us how they plan to spend the money. We go to Idaho to see if a tax on sporting equipment to save wildlife will fly. And on the Earth calendar, we inspect insect-eating flowers, which are now in bloom in Alabama. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Officials at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and the National Weather Service recently released flood predictions for the spring season. As expected, El Niño is playing a role in the weather patterns, and the areas most affected thus far will likely see more bad weather. As the Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports, NOAA officials also used the opportunity to unveil a program that they say could help reduce flood damage.
In its annual spring outlook, the National Weather Service's Hydrological Information Center forecasts that much of California and the southeastern United States will be susceptible to flood conditions. Not surprising, considering areas of California have received record rainfall. Heavy rains from El Niño have saturated the soil in California, Florida, and other parts of the southeast, where some flooding is already occurring. But Frank Richards, head of the Hydrological Center, says parts of the Northeast and New England may also experience flooding.
In each of those cases, we see El Niño's fingerprints there, in that, as you mentioned, California and Florida have seen very heavy rain. The Southeast, not only Florida, has seen extensive rains for about 30 to at least 90 days in some cases. In the Northeast, they've had substantial precipitation. And one of the areas we're concerned about is there's an awful lot of water in the snowpack. Back in early January, we had this devastating ice storm. Northern parts of the state absorbed much of that rain that froze in the ice in the snow cover, and we've got a very dense snow cover up there right now.
But the news is not all bad. Overall, flooding is expected to be less of a problem compared to last year. The National Weather Service says a warmer and drier than normal winter may spare residents of the Central Plains and along the Mississippi River the headaches many suffered 1 year ago. Officials say the Northwest should also see small amounts of flooding. However, Frank Richards warns that residents shouldn't let their guards down, especially in the spring.
And I would also like to indicate that even those areas where we haven't identified as areas of concern, weather can be very, very changeable. And the last thing we want people to do is say, well, my area of the country, the Weather Service is not too concerned about. I don't have to worry about flooding. Flooding can happen very rapidly. They need to be aware of what's going on in their area and take appropriate action. One of the things that we see over and over again are people simply don't respect the power of water. Most of the deaths in this country due to flooding are vehicle-related.
For residents of low-lying areas, spring floods have almost become a tradition. This has left many to criticize federal flood insurance policies that encourage construction and rehabilitation of properties in flood-prone areas. However, there has been some progress made to resolve these problems. Government officials are also trying to improve the way weather and flood predictions are made. The day the spring outlook was released, Commerce Secretary William Daley announced the Natural Disaster Reduction Initiative, or NDRI. It's a plan designed to reduce the impacts of natural disasters on communities. The plan provides $55 million for improving the National Weather Service's system of river forecasting, according to Frank Richards.
The Weather Service last year developed an advanced hydrologic prediction system in Des Moines, Iowa. This was an outgrowth of devastation they had in 93 and the flood there. And the first, it was very, very successful. The local emergency managers found it much more useful than the traditional approaches where we provided the information in a rather limited format. We have graphical products now that are much easier to absorb and products that give some sense of the uncertainty. One of the areas where we're going to implement this starting this year is, in fact, in the Red River Basin in the north central U.S. and also in the Columbia Basin in the northwest. And in particular, in the Columbia Basin, its benefit will be not only for flood prediction, but water supply management.
In addition, the NDRI would improve construction techniques and provide $3 million a year for research on wind, seismic, and fire engineering to make buildings more disaster resistant. The plan would also help communities and businesses safeguard jobs in hazard-prone areas. NDRI is included in President Clinton's 1999 budget, and Frank Richards believes it's an effective use of government funds.
But 5 years ago, the National Institutes of Science and Technology took a look at Weather Service modernization, and they determined that a number of the new technologies being brought online were going to provide a cost-benefit ratio of 8-to-1. In other words, for every dollar the federal government invested, the nation itself would benefit by an $8 return on that investment. And a very substantial portion of that was predicated on enhanced hydrologic support in the water management area. And so the amount invested here is going to be magnified greatly in terms of the benefits we get for better, wiser use of water.
Richards believes NDRI will save the country about $500 million from potential natural disasters. Whether the Congress agrees and decides to spend the money remains to be seen. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Last year, Ted Turner, businessman and environmentalist who founded Turner Broadcasting and CNN, announced that he would give the United Nations $1 billion, $100 million a year for the next 10 years. A large portion of these sums will support programs to improve the environment. Turner set up a foundation called the United Nations Foundation to administer and disperse the funds. He then hired Tim Wirth to be president and CEO of the foundation. Wirth had been a United States Senator from Colorado and was appointed by President Clinton as Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs. The foundation is just getting organized and hasn't made any grants yet, but I recently had a chance to talk to Wirth about the task ahead of him. Part of his agenda is to foster partnerships between UN agencies and non-governmental organizations, often referred to as NGOs. Tim, what are the environmental objectives that you hope that the foundation and you can achieve?
The United Nations Foundation was established to support UN causes, and it's our job to figure out which of the very many responsibilities the UN has that we are going to attempt to support. High on the priority list are clearly going to be environmental concerns, with a number one priority focused on climate change. We hope that we'll be able to move the process along to help to strengthen UN institutions in the area of dealing with climate and maybe to help to move the international climate debate as well.
Does that mean then that you will be making grants to specific agencies that are working on this?
Well, the way the system is going to work, Peter, is that the United Nations has set up in the Secretary General's office a small secretariat. And the proposals from within the UN system will come to that secretariat, and we will work closely with that secretariat in reviewing those proposals. Clearly, we're not just going to wait for things to come up, but we're going to be working aggressively with UNEP, for example, the United Nations Environment Program, with the United Nations Development Program, UNDP, with non-governmental organizations, to make sure that the right kinds of proposals get developed and come up through the system. So it'll be really a cooperative effort between us, the Secretary General's office, the cooperating agencies, and NGOs.
So to some degree, then, you will be, in effect, soliciting proposals in areas of primary concern.
Well, the UN will be doing that. We will not be out soliciting and having proposals come directly to us, but we're going to be defining those areas which we think are of the highest priority. And in the environmental arena, climate change is right at the top of the list. We're also, Peter, going to be focusing very extensively on population and population stabilization, obviously very closely related to environment and the protection of this world.
When it comes to climate change, where are the points that you think that the foundation can have the kind of impact that will begin to move it forward? Obviously, it's such a vast area. Where are the trigger points that you think can have the most impact?
I think there are a number of those. First, we have to figure out the formulation that will engage the developing world, particularly China, India, and Brazil. And working very closely with some other institutions that are engaged in this, we believe that we can act as a broker role with the ability to fund the coming together of some of the science and economic people in China together with some technical people around the world together with the UN agencies and develop a formulation that it can allow, we hope, allow China to buy into the overall Kyoto mandate. The second thing that we hope to be able to do is to help to see if the whole trading permits and the process that was engaged in Kyoto for joint implementation and emissions trading becomes a reality.
You mentioned that you would also be dealing directly with NGOs in some cases. How do you see those relationships working out?
We are not going to establish a large new institution of the UN Foundation, but rather want to work as closely as possible with existing institutions, both those within governments within the United Nations and non-governmental organizations built around the world. This work, to be effective, we believe, largely has to be a partnership in which, as we're developing programs, for example, on China, we're already trying to figure out how we engage the Chinese government, how we engage the appropriate Chinese economic and environmental institutions and individuals, with American NGOs who've had some extensive experience there, with the UN, who has a very creative office in Beijing. So how do we put that package together? We'd like to be able to do that, and that'll bring the NGOs involved with it, with the government, and perhaps the leverage and capacity of our money will move things more rapidly than might move otherwise.
That was Tim Wirth, president of the United Nations Foundation, which was just established by Ted Turner. Wirth says he hopes the foundation will be able to make its first grants in May. I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, which is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. If you have thoughts about how the United Nations should spend some of that money, give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email us at green@wamc.org. green@wamc.org. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. Computers, monitors, printers, fax machines, and copiers make up the fastest growing electric load in the business world. So when you can, shut them off. The problem is many of these gizmos must stay on all the time. It's hard to get a fax when the machine is turned off. But manufacturers are now making equipment that automatically puts itself to sleep when it's not in use. They go into hibernation, which cuts energy demand to a fraction. The EPA has started a program called Energy Star. It identifies energy-efficient office machines through a logo. It's a half circle with the word energy and a picture of a star inside. By converting to low-power state, personal computers cut energy use by 50 to 60%. So shut off the office equipment when you can, and when you buy your new machines, look for the Energy Star logo, or check out the EPA toll-free number 1-888-STAR-YES. That's 1-888-STAR-YES. That's Green Tips for this week. A coalition of wildlife activists wants Congress to levy a small fee on equipment purchased by people who play outdoors. The money would be turned over to states and used to buy habitat and increase recreational opportunities. But some opponents say the tax is unnecessary. From Boise, Idaho, Jill Hoyt has this report.
Yellow-headed blackbirds welcome spring in a wetland on the edge of Boise, Idaho. The singers hope to lure in a mate, but these days they're just as likely to lure in a group of people. Surveys by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service show birdwatching is the fastest-growing outdoor recreation activity. 20 million people watched birds in the early 1980s. Today, the number exceeds 54 million. Wildlife enthusiasts want to capitalize on this boom in birding and biking and hiking and fishing. They're asking Congress to levy a 5% tax on outdoor gear that consumers buy. The levy would never exceed $100 on any one item. President of the National Wildlife Federation, Mark Van Putten, says this Teaming with Wildlife initiative would bring in about $350 million a year. The money would go to states for wildlife habitat and recreation improvement.
It's modeled on a 60-year success story involving hunters and hunting equipment where over $3 billion has been collected and given back to the states through that program to provide additional hunting opportunities and enhance habitat for game species. So this would apply the same concept to non-game species and to a broader set of recreational opportunities than just hunting.
Surveys show that wildlife observers want clean, secure viewing areas with restrooms, as well as maps and signs that interpret nature. Teaming with Wildlife could fund those things. The levy could also help states rehabilitate streams polluted by grazing and logging, and buy conservation easements to compensate for new subdivisions that are paving over wildlife habitat, says Wayne Milchrist, Idaho's non-game wildlife manager.
We simply don't have any kind of money really to put into habitat. That's a big item. You know, land and habitat is a big ticket item, and we just don't have the ability to do that.
Not everyone likes the Teaming with Wildlife concept, though. Inside Boise's Moravia Corporation, workers cut coated cloth to produce kayaks, canoes, and rafts. Moravia CEO and whitewater outfitter Doug Timms questions whether wildlife habitat is actually decreasing.
I think it's an open question. I think the wildlife herds, especially for the big game species, particularly here in Idaho, are at historically high levels. Are we really headed down the tubes so that we need to throw another tax in there to solve it? Or are we really doing a better job already?
Timms opposes Teaming with Wildlife, saying his customers would have to pay an extra $100 when buying a $3,000 raft. But Dan Cohen of Petco, a mega chain with 470 stores, looks at the new concept as a business opportunity. Birdwatching, he notes, already brings in more than $5 million each year.
So we think that if we are seen as one who's concerned with the interest of those who are birdwatchers, we think that can translate into people who would, you know, prefer to shop at our stores. So yes, we're doing it for business reasons, but we're also doing it because we think it's the right thing to do.
Some shoppers at the Petco store in Boise agree. Victoria Kerpa stops her cart, laden with two kids, by an aisle stacked with bird food.
I think it's a good idea. If it's going to help, and usually people that buy those kind of things respect the environment and animals, I wouldn't mind paying an extra dollar.
But Virgil Lenners has some doubts.
Well, I don't know if I'd be too thrilled about 5% because I already buy a lot of bird food because I've got big macaws. But if they actually went to I guess, sanctuaries, that'd be no big deal.
Consumers like Kerpa and Lenners would pay about $10 annually if Teaming with Wildlife made it through Congress. The idea was debated last session but failed. President of the National Wildlife Federation, Mark Van Putten, expects a bill to be introduced this spring. He says Teaming with Wildlife offers a solution to the endangered species dilemma.
So there's no bigger threat to wildlife than habitat loss. And this will take a long-term preventative approach so that we don't have to rely on endangered species laws to save them when they're nearly gone.
Van Putten says about 600 businesses, including nationwide marketers of equipment like Bass Pro Shops, as well as 2,600 organizations, have signed on to the Teaming with Wildlife proposal. For the Environment Show, I'm Jill Hoyt in Boise, Idaho.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we broadcast, pitcher plants are blooming in Alabama's Grand Bay Bioreserve. The Nature Conservancy-managed 100,000-acre preserve is located in the southwestern section of the state. And pitchers are carnivorous plants, meaning they use bugs as a source of food. David Ruppel, project manager for the bioreserve, says there are many insectivorous plants growing in this wetland area.
Some of the most outstanding and most visible to most people are the pitcher plants, or as many of the folks call them here, sundews or buttercups. And here in coastal Alabama, we have five species that are most common. And in mid-March, the winged pitcher plant and the yellow pitcher plants are blooming. And in a properly managed habitat, it is amazing to look out and see basically a yellow carpet of 2 to 3 inch flowers. And it is amazing what these grassland areas look like if they're properly managed.
Ruppel says in late winter or early spring, the flower is the first thing that appears.
The parrot pitcher plant, the white top pitcher plant, and the purple pitcher plant have a deep crimson type flower, and they're not quite as widespread as the winged and the yellow in distribution, but they are pretty impressive in themselves. Then sometime after the flower itself comes out of the ground, the hollow trumpet shaped pitcher will appear, and in the case of the yellow and the winged, they are about 12 to 15 inches tall, and at the top of the leaf or the plant there would be a hood, and what that hood does is protect the digestive juices that are found within the plant from being diluted by rainwaters.
The soil in this part of Alabama is acidic. It's low in minerals and nutrients. The conditions aren't favorable for many plants, but for these carnivores, it's picture perfect. That's because pitcher plants survive on the large supply of insects that inhabit the bioreserve. Bugs are attracted to the plants, but the appeal is lethal.
On the pitcher plants, as I described the trumpet-like shape of the leaf itself, the bottom portion of that trumpet is filled with digestive enzymes and bacteria, which upon contact with insects will actually first drown and then digest the insect.
Small down-pointed hairs prohibit the insect from leaving the plant. The bug has nowhere to go but further into the flower. Unlike animals, pitcher plants don't have a choice in what they eat. They can't spit out a bug that may be lacking in taste, which means whatever crawls inside its tube of flower becomes a meal. Pitchers can't afford to be choosy because it may be a while before they capture another inquisitive visitor. If you cut one open, you can see the remains of bugs and even small frogs that met their demise in this attractive wetland dweller. David Ruppel says pictures remain visible until late fall. So if you're in southern Alabama, you might want to see some in the Grand Bay Bioreserve. Otherwise, you can see some great pitcher pictures on the internet. Search pitcher plant. But when the flower appears on the screen, don't crawl in because it may eat you up. Thanks for listening. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, it's trees again. This time, mahogany in the Amazon. The wood is so valuable that it moves in international trade like drugs. The trouble is you can't produce a new crop each year. We talk green about natural landscaping. Before you plant your garden or mow the lawn, hear this. Maybe you'll decide to let the grass grow. And then we set out in the temperate rainforest of Tasmania in search of an aboriginal ghost. Stay with us. Mahogany is probably the most sought-after furniture wood and the most expensive in the world today. One of the main reasons it's so expensive is that it is becoming increasingly difficult to find. But illegal timber harvesters are finding the precious wood deep in Brazil's Amazon forest, which is driving the tree to extinction and damaging the rainforest. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more.
The South American mahogany is by far the most valuable wood in the Amazon forest. Those illegally harvesting the trees will go to any length to get them, because in New York City, they're worth more than $700 per cubic meter. Mahogany grows at a slow rate, and at the pace they're being cut in the Amazon, experts predict the South American mahogany is destined for extinction.
What mahogany does is to wait for some larger kind of disturbance, something like a hurricane or kind of strong winds we have in the Amazon called blowdown that knock down bigger areas of forest. And then if there are one or two of the big adult trees that survive that, those are the trees that are going to put out seed and recolonize the mahogany. But those are exactly the trees that get cut when mahogany is being logged, so that this system doesn't work.
That's Dr. Philip Fernside with the National Institute for Research in the Amazon, speaking from the heart of the rainforest. He says a slow regeneration rate means you will rarely find young mahogany trees. This means that without future generations to replace the adults, the species is doomed. Professor Fernside says there are trees that loggers can cut a lot of, but mahogany isn't one of them. He says sustainable forestry is nearly impossible with this species.
Growing it in plantations in South America is possible, but it's difficult because there is a kind of insect that cuts off the bud after the tree gets a couple of meters high, shorter than it would have to be harvestable. To manage it in the natural forest is difficult because it requires disturbance, which means it would have a large environmental impact to do it.
Fernside says trying to create man-made blowdowns of the trees isn't feasible. This also makes the harvesting of mahogany a financially poor investment. The Brazilian government has taken measures to protect the South American mahogany from extinction. More technologically advanced aircraft are being used for monitoring, and the number of inspectors looking for illegal timber has increased. There is some legal harvesting being conducted, but according to studies by the Brazilian government, 80% of the mahogany being logged is obtained illegally. Dr. Fernside believes there is little that can be done to stop it.
And a lot of it comes from places like Indian reservations, where there's not supposed to be cutting going on. And then it gets disguised in different ways and exported. And this is... This means that there aren't any reliable numbers about how much is actually being taken out. Either it's declared as some other species that's less valuable, or else hidden altogether.
Professor Fernside says much of the illegal mahogany is sent to the United States and Europe. He says one way of reducing the illegal mahogany trade is to eliminate the market, which means, among other things, tougher border inspections. Fernside compares the mahogany trade to drug trafficking. As long as there are people who want it, there will be people to supply it, especially at today's prices.
You can't expect enforcement out in tropical countries to be able to contain the problem by itself when the product is so valuable that it attracts all kinds of ways around the regulations, bribing and armed guards, going out with the loggers and so forth, all kinds of things. And so there has to be some way that this unsustainable and damaging kind of timber production doesn't find a market, and only wood that is certified is coming from plantations or some sort of a low-impact system is able to find a market. And that requires changes in the importing countries.
For the past several years, Dr. Fernside and others have tried to get the South American mahogany listed as an endangered species during the CITES agreement, an international conference where countries regulate trade and the world's natural resources. At the CITES conference held last year in Zimbabwe, member countries again failed to recognize the mahogany as endangered, which would have put additional controls on those importing the tree. Professor Fernside hopes that CITES members will one day list the tree, but by then, it may be too little, too late. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Spring is creeping up on much of the country, and in those places where March snows make it seem like it'll never come, you can think spring by planting your garden. And if you don't have a garden, you can think about the kind of garden you would plant if you did have one. But the fact is that a lot of our gardening and a lot of our landscaping simply makes no sense. In some parts of the country, we plant green lawns in environments that have never sustained Kentucky bluegrass, and then we use infinite amounts of water to keep it alive. In other places, we plant exotic plants that require a lot of fertilizer and herbicides. So a growing group of folk are saying, wait a minute. If we plant things that are natural to the area that we live in, they may grow better. And we can create landscapes that are easier to maintain, are more attractive, and are working with the environment rather than in spite of it. So today we're talking about natural landscaping. If you have any thoughts or comments of your own, please give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And my guests are two PhDs who have thought a lot about this. One is Mark Hostetler. He's an ecologist at Arizona State University who researches ecology in urban areas. And the other is Mark Schiller, who is professor of architecture at the University of Southern California. He's the author of a book called Energy Efficient Environmental Landscaping. So, Mark Schiller, let's
start with you. When we talk about environmental landscaping, what is it?
Well, there's two aspects. One is we do want to plant something around our building that helps the building to respond to the climate. We create microclimate, as it were, around the building, and that changes the way that the building uses energy. And then the second is that the plantings that we use themselves, of course, use water and other resources, and we want to be careful about how we do that.
And so, Mark Hostetler, as an ecologist at Arizona State University, is this whole business of natural landscaping something that is catching on? Is there some real potential here?
Well, actually, my take on the issue is that urban landscapes, there's some estimates that there's just, in, like, for example, in the United States, there's just the same amount of urban landscapes as wilderness areas. And so it's becoming such a huge factor, and it's so prominent across North America that it affects a lot of animal species. And so my take of it is that in the future, if we want to conserve a lot of species, we really got to think about ways to attract a wide variety of species, just not the ones that we consider pests in these urban areas.
So how do you do that? I mean, that's a great thing to say, but Mary homeowner, John homeowner, sitting in suburban Chicago, what do they do?
Well, there's some simple solutions. First of all, lawns are like concrete to most animals, and you will attract a few starlings and some chinch bugs and stuff like this, but a lot of species will not use lawns. And so the best way is to, for the areas that you don't use as much on your property, don't mow.
You realize that you're attacking part of a state religion, the idea of America without lawns? That sounds almost unpatriotic.
It's a cultural institution, and it's a billion-dollar industry, and it came back from our roots from England, where the English really promoted these gardens, and people kind of like this vista of savanna landscapes with large trees with short crop grass. And actually, it might be a little bit of our evolutionary psyche that, being evolving in the African Rift Valley, we kind of like these landscapes. But now the population is so huge and people are concerned about our impact on animal species and even plant species, we got to really turn our eye to suburban landscapes. And
So before we get to Mark Schiller about specific plantings, when it comes to the lawn, what do you advise that people do?
With the lawn, depending where you are, the seed rain, when I'm saying seed rain, seeds coming from a variety of natural sources, if you just stop mowing the lawn, the reason if lawn outcompetes the native vegetation because you're continually chopping off the native vegetation, but when you don't mow it, the native vegetation will take it over, so eventually you get more wildflowers, shrubs, et cetera, in your lawn. And if you want to go a step further, plant native species, bushes and trees in different parts of your yard, because a lot of the animal species are adapted to native vegetation, but not exotic vegetation.
And so, Mark Schiller, how do you translate that or combine that with some of your thinking about energy conservation and, again, how people manage their property?
Well, I think the two ideas actually can get along pretty well. What we do is we have different guidelines for different parts of the country, different climates. In a temperate climate, you plant foliage on the east and west of the building to shade the building in the summer. It just, in some ways, makes good sense. On the south side, on the other hand, you want to be a little careful. You don't want to plant things too close into the building that would shade it during the winter. The sun path is different in the summer and the winter, and so you can make plantings that shade in the summer when you need it and don't shade in the winter so that you can have that sun. I think that there are a lot of little details that we cover in the book, but the basic principles are like common sense, and I think that that's kind of what Mark is talking about, too. In a way, it's applying common sense to what we do instead of preset notion of what it's supposed to look like.
And are you talking then primarily of ways to protect the building from sun and outside forces that affect temperature and energy use? Is that basically
that's exactly
the
right. I think that in a way we look at our environment from a macro point of view as well. You know, when you use energy in a building, you're also damaging the environment. And so it benefits you not to use that energy. You have to pay for it. but it also benefits the environment as a whole. And I think Mark, the other Mark, is looking at it more in a micro sense, that there's a micro environment that you want to deal with as well.
Well, let's go to the energy piece for a moment. If one were to follow the kind of advice that you've laid out in your book, Energy Efficient Environmental Landscaping, and I gather created more shade and more intelligent use of plantings, do you have any sense on a national basis as to how much energy that might save or what kind of impact we're talking about?
Well, it's easy to calculate on an individual basis. We've done studies, and other people have done studies that we've got, that show in a temperate climate or a cold climate, it's not unreasonable to get a 30% improvement. Now, of course, that depends a little bit on whether your house is real well insulated and so on. It's always easy to get the first 30% and harder to get the last five. So, in a cold climate, 30% is not unreasonable.
And I guess you're talking here about trees that lose their leaves in the wintertime, so you get the benefit of sunshine and the cold weather.
Right, exactly. Well, it's wonderful that nature itself responds to climate. Nature responds to weather. You know, when you have a long, cold winter, a deciduous tree doesn't pop into leaf quite as soon. So it's automatically somewhat responsive to the particular weather that year. The other thing I'd like to love to point out is that nature gets better in its climate response over time. Mechanical equipment wears out. Trees don't wear out. They grow. They become larger, fuller, stronger. The kinds of solutions we're talking about also get better over time, as opposed to requiring, mechanical solutions.
I guess it's kind of like us, that the older we get, the more we sweat in hot weather. Natural systems work.
Yes, yeah.
Mark Hostetler, you did some interesting things with a lawn in Florida. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I live in a suburban neighborhood in Gainesville, Florida, and we haven't mowed our lawn for 5 years now. And so it's been interesting dealing with the neighborhood association and people around that area. And
every kid in the neighborhood is going broke because he can't get a few bucks for cutting your lawn.
Well, actually, what I do is a design called controlled chaos. You set aside patches where you just don't mow the lawn. You put trails, mulch trails throughout the lawn. So it's aesthetically pleasing to the human eye, but yet it's usable by a variety of species. And to give you one example of the importance of this, not only at the local scale, but at the large scale, anecdotally, every third bite of food that you take has been pollinated by some insect. And the species that do most of the pollination now, because our native species are being decimated because we're transforming landscapes into urban areas, is the European honeybee is taking over the pollination role. Well, unfortunately, the European honeybee is, the populations are declining, and so a lot of people who rely on this honeybee are trying to turn to native pollinators, and they're asking, where are they? Well, they're not around because we've really transformed the landscape, so doing your little bit by adding more flowers, native flowers, and patches in your backyard, you're actually, in a way, helping the crop industry, not only vegetables that you plant in your yard, but in a larger scale, some of the orange groves and pecan groves that are pollinated by native pollinators.
You know, an example of how far we've gone afield, about a year ago, I had on this same program a lawyer who had brought a lawsuit against the city of Chicago because they had a weed law, a law that basically said if the weeds got too high on your property and you didn't cut them down, you could be fined, and it was a criminal offense. And he was part of a program trying to restore native prairie. And when the criminal law kicked in with respect to his folks, he decided he was going to go and was prepared to go to the United States Supreme Court on the ground that this was unconstitutional because it was vague, because my weed or your weed might be my rose or whatever. But it does illustrate how far we've come from trying to use nature to help us rather than the other way around. So let me ask you both something. If one is a homeowner or living in a neighborhood and has some impact on the planting and management of the space, here it is, spring is coming. What do you think people ought to be doing today as they anticipate a growing season which is upon them? Mark Hostetler, where do you start?
Well, again, think about what you use your property for. There's lots of areas that are low traffic areas, like the corners of your property that might border up to your neighborhood or your neighbor's property. And with those areas, think about ways where you can just let things go. The easiest solution is just not mow it. If you tend to live in a very urban area where you just don't get many weeds popping up, people call them weeds, but I call them flowers, try seeding them with some native varieties and see what comes up. And the more area you give to native vegetation, not only do you get more insects that pollinate butterflies, etc., but you get a lot more birds, too, that use the structure to nest in and to feed in.
And your comments about lawns in the macro sense, it seems to me, have huge implications. There are states that mow the sides of their interstates to look like lawns for miles and miles and miles. Corporate
yes.
headquarters turn acres of good fields into lawns.
Yes, and at a very large scale, you can think about, you know, all the sod that we use for lawns is grown somewhere. It's like an agricultural crop. And so there's huge acres, thousands of acres used just to grow sod. And so
okay, our time is running short. So, Mark Schiller, we've heard where Mark Hostetler would start, which is to let the grass grow. Where would you advise the homeowner to start as they're thinking about their spring plantings?
Well, I would say that they should sit down and think long-term a little bit as well. Think about where they can plant things that, as they grow, will protect the building from sun during the times that it's too hot, won't require tremendous amounts of water, and will make sure that sun is available when it's a little too cold. You can do that by finding out the sun angles from your area for your latitude and the sun path, and then sit down, draw your building, and chart out where the sun path will be, chart out where the winds will be coming from, and
okay,
you can feel that.
Well, that is tremendous advice. I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking with Mark Hostetler from Arizona State University and Mark Schiller from the University of Southern California about natural landscaping. And we'd like you to share your questions or comments with us. Give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Let us know what you think about the Environment Show by responding to the questionnaire on our website. The address is www.enn.com/envshow. You can also hear the Environment Show anytime through the website on your personal computer. Again, it's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author David Quammen, his special place is Hobart, Tasmania, located off the southern coast of Australia, a beautiful place with Aboriginal ghosts. In this portrait of place, Quammen reads from his book titled Wild Thoughts from Wild Places.
Within a few days after landing in Hobart, the Tasmanian capital, I've learned this much. Tasmania is complicated. It's an oxymoronic place, combining the gentility of English-style tea rooms with the raw sort of high country wilderness I know from Montana. A former penal settlement, notorious for its harshness, graced today by an especially free-spirited variant of the breezy Australian charm. A wet, chilly landscape that supports its own version of temperate rainforest on the far side of the tropics. Profoundly alien, yet somehow oddly familiar, Tasmania defies categories and confutes expectations. It's part of Australia, yet detached, a separate island down under the down under. It's a final refuge for some of the rarest marsupial species. Even the Tasmanian Aborigines are distinct, having been isolated genetically and culturally from mainland Aborigines throughout most of the past 12,000 years. When that isolation was suddenly breached by explorers, by whalers and sealers, then by British penal authorities and convicts, and eventually by settlers, the very distinctness of the Tasmanians became their greatest disadvantage. It left them vulnerable to disease and conquest. It led to talk of domestication, hybrids, and finally, extinction, as though they themselves were an endemic marsupial species. It made possible all manner of perniciously simplified notions, including the one that a certain William Lanny was the last Tasmanian Aboriginal man. I have come to this area because I'm interested in the factual and emotional realities of William Lanny's life. I plan to walk in the mountains for 5 days and meditate over a ghost. I want to glimpse his landscape and try to imagine a few of his feelings. I have a map and a 3-sentence clue to guide me. The map is a pocket-sized topographical projection of Cradle Mountain Lake St. Clair National Park. The 3-sentence clue appears on a display panel at the visitor's center near the north end of the park. After the 1835 drive by George Augustus Robinson to collect Aborigines and establish them on a mission at Flinders Island, the Cradle Mountain area became a refuge for one Aboriginal family, it begins. I've read elsewhere about this Robinson, another shimmering, ambivalent figure in Tasmanian history, famed for his friendly crusade to round up the native people and stuff them away on an offshore reservation, ostensibly for their own protection. By 1836, Robinson believed that he'd gotten them all, except for the stubbornly elusive Cradle Mountain family. These people refused to join the mission and were probably the last Tasmanian Aborigines to follow a traditional lifestyle. The family was finally captured in 1842. During a brief stop at the visitor's center, I copy those 3 sentences into my notebook, not yet aware of the human particulars, the gruesome climax to this story, or how often the words last and finally will recur. In addition to the map and the notebook, I'm carrying 1 kilogram of rice, 1 kilogram of muesli, $60 worth of dried fruit, a few freeze-dried dinners, a tent, a rain parka, rain pants, cold weather clothing, binoculars, a headlamp, a bird book, a mammal book, a pint of Jim Beam, a detailed guidebook on Australian backcountry hikes, and a paperback history of Tasmania. Before even reaching the trailhead, I realize it's too much. My pack is bloated and leaden. So I rip 6 crucial pages out of the backcountry guide, stow them in a pocket, and give the book away. Just before dawn, on Wednesday of Easter week, I start walking.
That was author David Quammen, reading from his book, Wild Thoughts from Wild Places. It's published by Scribner. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You don't have to buy a lawnmower this spring. If you buy a tape of this show instead, it's a lot cheaper. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and order show number 428. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.